Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. A number of things have been going on over the last couple of weeks. Probably the thing that's been most up on the radar is what's been going on in Iran and the takeover of the British embassy, or as President Obama likes to say, the English embassy, which the Brits didn't take exception to. But what is happening there, Jim?
Well, the problem has always been, at least since 1979, that the Iranian government is controlled by several factions. The only thing they're united on is they don't want a monarchy. They want some kind of democracy. But the faction that basically won the struggle started after the 1979 revolution that overthrew the Shah was a clerical faction. And they basically changed the constitution in the middle of a war when nobody was really looking so that a council of senior clerics has veto power over anything the government does. And using that, they got control of the judiciary, the police force, and they established their own private army, the Revolutionary Guards. And that group also has factions. Some of them are much more radical. And the guy we hear most about, Ahmadinejad, the president the elected president of Iran, is actually an enemy of the religious council, because Ahmadinejad got elected partly on his reputation as an enemy of corruption. Because one of the things the religious leaders did, as religious leaders do in every country where they've taken power, is they've become immensely corrupt. It's not just religious leaders, it's just people who believe they're on a mission from God and are married and have families. Although even Catholic, sovereign popes will get corrupted. But anyway, be that as it may, without any feedback mechanism, in other words, nobody can remove you from power except God, and, God's been sort of like out of touch for a long time. You tend to do whatever the hell you want. The problem with that in Iran is that there are many factions that believe that they are in direct touch. They're getting the word from on high. And these groups will not come out and fight each other per se, because they still do accept the fact that, yes, they're all devout and religious Muslims, Shia Muslims, and particularly come to this understanding that up to a certain, and that's clearly the fine limit, you can do whatever the hell you want. So you have the radicals in the religious dictatorship in Iran, doing things like starting private wars, smuggling guns to Hamas in Gaza, and having their ships bombed, in the Red Sea by Israeli UAVs, and as happened last week, sending several hundred of their fanatic bully boys to invade the British embassy. Now, a lot of Iranian leaders were aghast at this, but the faction was exercising its right. It says, we can do this. Yeah, 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 that's the deal. Because the religious leadership knows that they only have the support of a minority of the Iranians, maybe 20-30% if push comes to shove. But among that 20-30% are thousands of guys in the basically in the Revolutionary Guard reserve who are willing to die, not just to kill, but more importantly, to die to keep their corrupt bosses in power. And of course, what makes all this work is the oil, which is why Iran is so upset about increasing sanctions, because that makes it more expensive for them to sell their oil and, get paid for it, which is another thing entirely, which is not good to get into on a podcast. So they have all these problems. The biggest one being they're very unpopular, and a second growing problem, which isn't that well known outside of Iran, in that these the various factions within the government are starting to fight each other and are basically making the Iranian government look like it's out of control, which in many respects it is, because there are some crazy things going on inside of Iran which are liable to trigger an actual rebellion. For example, the religious extremists are insisting on more tight control over the women. For example, they want to set up separate men's and women's colleges. Now, we know in the West that when you mess with the women too much, you get in big trouble. And I'm not just talking about marriage. I'm talking about politics in general. And this is exactly what's happening in Iran, because in Iran, the women were never, you know, suppressed, as it were, as much as they were in many other parts of, say, just the Middle East. The Iranian women had basically a nomad tradition where the women rode horses, used weapons, and basically took care of business when the men couldn't. And they're trying to suppress this. Same thing's going on in Saudi Arabia, which is why there's so much pushback. You know, that relatively recent thing about women can't drive cars. I mean, that outraged women. But, you know, what makes women dangerous is they'll just sit there and wait and, you know, they'll take their time, you know, getting their way. The men are finding out that this is very dangerous, especially in Iran. And that's what they're worried about, you know, the various factions doing too many out of control and outrageous things, upsetting too many people, especially inside Iran, and bringing the whole edifice, you know, down on their heads, and putting them all out of business. So, you know, what's happening in Iran is not what it appears to be.
Interesting. Austin?
Well, it's kind of, I really don't have much to add to that. We're seeing the, I've argued before on Strategy Talk, and certainly made this in some of the commentary we've done on Strategy Page, that really the Khomeiniist regime, not only and I say that after the Ayatollah role of Khomeini, you know, the Khomeiniist regime, which is this strange conglomeration of both clerics and Revolutionary Guards militants, and really are the armed force and also run the secret police, they feel a lot of pressure from not just internal pressure and factional pressure, but example this year, they're fighting a rear guard battle in Syria with their Syrian ally, the Assad regime, really slowly losing ground to really 20 different or so, two dozen rebel groups within Syria, and they've invested a great deal, the Khomeini's regime has, in the Assads since 1979. Syria's their conduit to Hezbollah in Lebanon, and even Hamas in Gaza, and the loss of Syria would greatly hurt the expansionist. As I say, expansionist, but really the tank capacity of the regime to cause trouble, destabilize its perceived enemies in the Middle East, and I think that the attack on Great Britain in part, you know, it's a replay of 1979 in some ways with the attack on the American embassy, but the Iranian regime is under stress, and this the telling point about the attack on the British embassy, Dan, was, I saw this, you know, three or four nights ago on television. This was the image off of Iranian state television. They had an Israeli flag, an American flag, and a British flag. It was all framed, and then they set them all on fire. That's the propaganda image they want to sell domestically and to some degree regionally. You know, we're the only force, you know, radical enough and strong enough to actually confront British imperialists, the great Satan, the United States, and the Israelis. bluster. I actually think that brittleness instead of it's bluster, but it's caused by a certain kind of brittleness. I'm offering a theory on this, but I think I've seen this going on, the decay in the regime, corruption, as Jim mentioned, corruption is rampant. June 2009, we had the rise of a really widespread, highly factionalized, but widespread dissent movement within Iran when the June elections of 2009 were contested, and that became the Green Movement. Has the regime repressed the Green Movement? Yes. Has the Green Movement gone away? No. It remains the disgust, outright hatred, and desire for change by a substantial portion of the Iranian people remains, which is sounds a little bit like a potential Arab Spring type revolt. That's exactly what the regime fears. And the attack on the British embassy, I see this as, you know, it's they're looking for publicity, a certain kind of publicity, show their strength, show that they'll confront the imperialists, but at the same time, they're a brittle regime, and that's, again, I think it's a rear guard type action, and it needs to be seen in that strategic context.
It's interesting.
Well, I mean, that's
yeah, because the British embassy was an important window to the West for the Iranians. The British have been in that part of the world for centuries. I mean, there's some bad blood, but hey, that's what happens when your neighbors in that neighborhood. But there were many Iranians who felt that they could basically use the Brits to communicate. They could get an honest, opinion as to what if we do this. They felt that the Brits understood the chaotic situation in Iran. And this may have been one reason why the one faction, basically did the unthinkable in diplomatic terms, attacked and trashed an embassy, because they don't want Iran to have that kind of access to the West. They want to totally cut them off. I mean, that's not saying xenophobic stuff you see, all over the world from time to time. Ourselves alone, as it were. And it never comes to any good end.
Right. Now, the attack on the British embassy has also caused a lot of the other Western embassies that were there to shut down, too, now.
Exactly.
So,
that's why they went after the British. The British is the senior diplomatic, muck-a-muck. It usually is. They've been at it longer than anybody else. And so, as goes Britain's embassy, so goes everybody else. I mean, basically people are saying, my God, if they went after the Brits, we're all at risk. Except maybe for the Swiss.
Right. So it's basically total isolation from the West now at this point.
Well, it's not isolation as much as it's more difficult to communicate. You got to remember that there's an enormous amount of traffic of people and communications in general with the Gulf states, Qatar and Dubai and what have you. And you can always arrange discreet meetings between diplomats or even senior government officials, by going to Qatar or Dubai or what have you. But you no longer have people inside the country. And although you can send people to the country, but they're at more risk now because there's no embassy there to help protect them. People of Iranian, ancestry who basically were born in Iran, like many countries, they don't recognize you becoming the citizen of another country. So if you're an Iranian who was born in Iran, went to America, became a naturalized citizen, you come back to Iran. As far as they're concerned, you're Iranian. And if they feel like throwing you in jail for any whatever reason, they will. And they've actually killed, I think, one Canadian woman. And there have been numerous cases of this. But even if you're not an ethnic Iranian, you're wandering around, and your embassy is no longer there. I mean, for example, Americans are warned, do not go to Iran. You're seen as, kidnap bait and grab you and do whatever the hell they want. And some Americans have indeed disappeared in Iran, never to be heard from again. So it's just, yes, it makes it more dangerous for people to go there, but you can still send people in, agents or whatever, because even Western countries, if they'll give you a visa, or permission, whatever, to go to Iran, you will often be contacted by somebody from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs or whatever to ask you, was it okay? Well, basically, they're fishing for information. And some people will say, well, let me come in and we'll have a cup of tea and a chat. And that's how all countries, basically use their own citizens to collect information on what's going on. But it's just more difficult. And that's what's happening with Iran. The sanctions don't stop Iran from doing things, but it makes it more difficult. So basically, everybody's getting more aggravated because things are becoming more difficult. And that sort of thing, eventually, it's like a steam pot where you shut off the exit. Eventually, it's going to explode. And some Iranian factions believe yes, because then they'll have a chance of establishing an even stricter, dictatorship. And the basic problem is the Iranian people do not want another revolution. They went through a revolution. They went through a very costly war with Iraq. And that's basically kept the Iranian, religious, leadership in power. But a new generation is coming up who were born, long after the 1980s or after the 1980s. And to them, this war and this revolution is something their parents and grandparents talked about. And they are just angry. And if they get angry enough, boom.
I've got a slightly different take on that. I think the Iranians would like very much, the mass of Iranians, to see the regime change, Dan.
Oh, yes, I agree.
What Tim is saying is that they don't want to spill blood for it because they've been so hellaciously bled out since 1979. The bloodletting that went on for the better part of a decade after the Saddam Hussein's invasion of Iran started the Iran-Iraq war, it was a slaughterhouse. And I would recall 1994-95, as a matter of fact, it was a discussion that informed the 1996 edition Quick and Dirty Guide to Wars chapter on Iran. Jim and myself talking about, are the Iranians ready to make that commitment to the blood spilling that this revolution is going to take, and they haven't crossed that. They've come close. 2009, you start to see indications that it's there, and I know that the regime and the security forces saw that.
And the government came down hard on those people who were basically nonviolent. Yeah. And they're still executing, and they're still in jail. They are afraid. And the government is afraid.
Well, that's what I mean about being brittle on this. But the thing is, though, is that when Jim's saying, talking about that reluctance on it, you take a look at the horror that look, Iran has had a terrible existence over the last 32 years, a totally failed revolution, a major war, and it is a good, corrupted revolution. The Democrats, the liberals, were all driven out by, I don't want to say 82 or 83, Abul Hassan Bani Sadr, who was the first post-Shah president, and he was one of the spokespeople, leaders in the early part of the revolution. He's been in exile since, I want to say, late 1981. I've been reading some of his comments about Arab Spring. He's very, very enthusiastic about it, but he points out the democratic impulse that was present in the Iranian revolution. It was completely undermined by the religious radicals. If you use crudely the comparison Bolsheviks versus Mensheviks, going back to the Bolshevik revolution of 1917 in Russia, the Bolsheviks are willing to kill you, the Mensheviks, moderates, they want to try to build political coalition. So the Khomeinists were essentially a hard line. Again, I'm putting this in italics. I mean, it's a comparison. Bolshevik, and they tossed the modernizers, which might be a better word to use than liberalizers, even though there were classic liberal elements in that Iranian revolution of 1979. They're all gone. They're all failed. And it's a warning sign, too, to the modernizers and liberalizers in Arab Spring. Watch it, because the extremist, militant extremist factions are going to try to I'd say pulling Iran. I'm being a bit, making a not quite one-to-one comparison, but that's one of the components that's in play in Arab Spring 2011, undermining what are legitimate, popular revolutions that have a democratic, pluralist component, being taken over by a one-party theocratic state. But part of that, the economic corruption that's gone along with it, oppression by the secret police, and all of the burdens of endless warfare. And that's the Iranian people. At the same time, you've got this group that is on the verge of reaching the open rebellion point. You still have all these folks that said, they've beaten on us so long, and we've suffered so much. Maybe they'll just go away. And that's one of the social and psychological tensions in Iran right now that's so hard to estimate. It's very hard to estimate. I don't think I'm saying anything that anybody else hadn't noticed before, but that's the tension in there. We've suffered so much, and maybe it's better just to continue to suffer.
Right.
Rather than spill more blood.
The mullahs do try and spread the money around. And that has caused problems. For example, Ahmadinejad withdrew many of the old oil and the food subsidies, which is something, dictatorships love to do, bread and circuses, as it were, bread and oil. They had to do it because basically it was bankrupting the country. And a lot of the oil was being exported to neighboring countries where there was no subsidy and you could sell the stuff for a tiny profit. They managed to pull that off without an uprising because a lot of Iranians realized, as much as I like this cheap, gasoline and kerosene, it's bankrupting us. So they are spreading the money around, which is good, because if you don't do that, you definitely get a revolution. And you can see how well that works, for example, in Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, where although there were Arab Spring, uprisings, they were quickly diffused as the demonstrators had their mouths stuffed with gold, as the British like to say when they do that. It does work. But the corruption in Iran is what really irritates people, because basically it means the children of the mullahs throw their weight around. These kids are not, some of them are, but most of them are not religious scholars, toy boys, or just businessmen who say, look, I got my cell phone here and I got a direct line to heaven or whatever. They have all sorts of little, sly terms for what they can do if you do not give them a chunk of your new business or whatever. Or why can't I get the cell phone contract for such and such part of Iran? It's because you're not connected. And this does aggravate people a whole lot, especially when prices go up or service sucks and what have you. He says, well, you can't argue because, the owner of that company is connected. This builds up over time, but you can delay it for a long time, which the Iranian mullocracy has done, simply by trying to buy off those people who are, the most danger to you. But eventually it catches up with you. What a lot of these guys are hoping is that they'll, have gone to their paradise, as it were, before the whole thing explodes. It's a musical chairs. It's a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah.
They're all Bernie Madoffs with guns.
or John Corzine with guns, one of the two. Let's talk a little bit about Pakistan and the supposed friendly fire incident over the
This is the country no one wants. Pointed out in strategy page many times, what goes on the border is beyond belief. Basically, you have the Pakistanis, and they have done this for decades. Their border guards are paramilitary, sometimes part-time, tribesmen hired locally. Now, this makes a lot of sense. They know the territory, they know the people, but they can be threatened and they can be bribed. And that's what the Taliban do. Because the Taliban, it's factions. The Taliban are a faction of the tribe, which is basically into, religious fanaticism and, large-scale banditry. in the name of God, as it were. And what has happened many times, and this has been reported in the American media, but not in context, you know, American or Afghan troops were fired at from across the border. And at times will even mention, the fire seemed to come from the Pakistani border post, you know, the main roads, there aren't that many roads, fortified little compounds on either side, the Afghan side and the Pakistani side, and there are garrisons of paramilitary or police or whatever, and they will sometimes shoot at one another, but sometimes they'll just shoot at, you know, somebody else. You know, they have mortars, heavy machine guns and what have you. And so this isn't generally understood in the West, even though it's printed in the papers. But what is going on here is, and the Pakistanis do this on the Indian border. In fact, they've been doing it on the Indian border longer than they've been doing it on the Afghan border, because during the 1980s, there were Russians on the other side of the border. And you do not shoot at the Russians, you know, just to play with them. They will shoot back many times over. But once the Afghans and the Americans moved in, they felt, hey, we can get away with things. And one of the things they get away with is basically to open fire on the border guards and distract them so that you can basically move Taliban or plain old smugglers. They've been doing this on the Indian border for years, especially in Kashmir. In fact, it started a war in 1999, the Kargil War. That's how the latest, the Musharraf, the general of the Pakistani Armed Forces, that's how he came to take over the Pakistani government. Because the elected government did not authorize him to start a war with India by basically letting the normal border guards attacking, you know, their counterparts in India get out of control. And the army did this deliberately. They said, well, let's teach these Indians a lesson. And they did not ask the civilian government. They just went ahead and did it. And when the civilian government tried to dismiss, Musharraf and his cronies, Musharraf said, oh, no. You know, we got the guns, you don't. You just get votes. And for the next 8 years, it was a military government. So in Pakistan, firing across the border and getting bombed for it is generally justified homicide. There have been several incidents where the Afghan or American troops who are being fired at from across the border, they call in an airstrike. And remember, we're talking GPS here. The guy says, all right, here are the coordinates. This is where the firing is coming from. Drop a bomb on them, and it will stop. And it does. But in this case, the firing was coming from, you know, a border patrol headquarters, you know, a base. And it got blown up, and a bunch of Pakistani border guards, who were probably the people firing, it's happened before, got killed, and Pakistan decided to be righteous about it. I mean, what are you going to do if you're caught, you know, in the act? What do you do? Go on the offensive. As far as they're concerned, that's the best way to deal with this sort of thing. But anybody in the area, and I've spoken to some, tell me that, oh, no, Pakistanis are used this regularly, this scam of, you know, firing across the border to, you know, either to just to intimidate their counterparts on the Afghan side, or to simply provide cover for, you know, some kind of smuggling or, you know, illicit movement across the border. Or just to, you know, raise hell, just to basically intimidate the patrols. There's more Afghan army patrols on the Afghan side of the border, and the Pakistanis simply want to assert dominance, which is a classic way of attending to one's affairs in that part of the world. This is Pushtun territory, and among the Pushtun tribes, you basically determine who is top dog, who has the biggest guns and the most willingness to use them. But in this case, you know, it's like the old days with the Russians. You got the Americans with their damn smart bombs. And the Pakistani government is basically trying to shut down the smart bombs. Because what they'd like to get out of all this is for the American government to say, you can no longer, you know, if you get fired on from a Pakistani border post, turn it over to the State Department. You know, run away and take cover and call the State Department, which is what the Pakistanis are hoping will happen, and might, for all we know.
Right. Austin?
Not much to add other than one of the possibilities that I've seen discussed and it went through my mind was that this was a bit of a trap by looking for an incident with the United States. Pakistan's fighting its own internal low-grade civil war. There's a civil war within the intelligence service, so it could have been set up. I'm not suggesting this is a conspiracy theory, you know, just as something that, depending on what the investigation turns up, and we've got an investigation into the incident going on now. So it's clear, NATO said that it was a mistake and apologized for it, but again, it could have been influence used to bait Afghan and NATO forces into launching an attack. So that's make that comment and leave it at that.
Yeah, but again, the thing to keep in mind is this has happened before. But in the past, the Pakistani government, they knew they were basically in the wrong. And they just, you know, let it slide. And in the past, when, for example, after the Bin Laden incident, which should have been extremely embarrassing for the Pakistanis, they basically got up on their soapbox and said, "Hey, you know, you're violating our sovereignty. You know, we're a sovereign nation, and you invaded us." And you know, most Americans and Westerners in general are unaware of how this has been played inside of Pakistan. And you can read, there's a lot of English language Pakistani media, and you get the impression that, you know, they're talking about an entirely different situation, whether it be, you know, the Bin Laden raid or what's going on the border. Not just this incident, but, you know, for years. They, as Austin pointed out, the military has their own needs. They have their own factions, but their basic problem is they are the problem. And more Pakistanis are becoming aware of that. You know, the army has their own chunk of the economy. They live well, much better than the average Pakistani, and they maintain all of this by maintaining the illusion that Pakistan is under threat from Afghanistan, from India, from the United States, from whomever. And if you don't throw more money at the army, something bad is going to happen. Yeah, something bad is going to happen. You're going to have another military junta, but they don't say that.
Right. Well, that's a good place to wrap up. Good discussion today, and we'll talk to you next time.
Take care.
Bye, guys.